ardiente.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we do celebrate this day, the Martin Luther King Jr. Day, with a two-hour special. This part one is inspired by a piece written by Charles Johnson, who is one of America's great philosophers and writers, who wrote The Middle Passage and many, many more books, 40-odd books. He was on just recently talking about his book, The Taming of the Ox, as his reflections of being Buddhist and black in America. And he'll be joining us soon for this new book that he did with one of our guests, Ethelbert Miller, coming up soon. And he wrote this piece called The King We Need. And the quote that he begins his essay with is from Martin Luther King. It really kind of grabbed Charles Johnson a lot. The quote is, "The great problem facing modern man is that the means by which we live have outdistanced the spiritual ends for which we live." And to wrestle with that and more, we have E. Ethelbert Miller, one of America's great poets and literary activists, on the board of the Institute for Policy Studies, director of the African American Resource Center, Howard University, former chair of the Humanities Council of D.C. Ethelbert, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Oh, thanks for inviting me, Mark. Good to be back with you.
Dr. Gilda Daniels, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, and Dr. Stacey Peterson, who is Associate Professor and Chair of Communication Arts, the School of Arts and Sciences at Notre Dame of Maryland University. And welcome back. Good to have you with us, too.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. And please join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. And one of the things that Charles Johnson posits in this is that he sees Martin Luther King, Ethelbert, as one of the most important spiritual and philosophical thinkers we've ever created, which is something we don't think about a lot when it comes to King. I'm glad he wrote this essay.
Well, you know, it begins with that fact that Charles Johnson is a philosopher also.
Yes, he is.
So he looks at King a certain way. He also did a lot of research for his novel, Dreamer, which came out in 1998, which is based on King as a character. So I think that what you're dealing with here is a person now who's writing essays about a man that he really studied, not simply a person that we celebrate in terms of their birthday every year.
So why do we think that this is even what Charles Johnson wrote, which is attached on our website at steinershow.org, is so important to think of him this way? You know, not just to think of him as – throughout this hour, 2 hours, I keep thinking about the one thing that America does is think of I have a dream speech, and when we'll see the day when our sons and daughters, black and white, will walk hand in hand and all that that we want to remember, but not the other parts of that speech or the things he did. Why is this notion of King as a serious social philosopher so important?
You know what, we have a tendency of reducing people either to a speech, a monument, or a movie, okay? I think that when we talk about King, and this is how I teach him, I think that what we should look at first is not his speeches, but his sermons. Okay, so one would go back and pick out a book like Strength to Love, which came out in 1963, and there's where you find the philosophical King. You know, you would get a sprinkling of this in his speeches, but you go to his sermons to get an essence of who he was. And then you also have to look at King in terms of his entire life, okay? Because here, the beauty of King is sort of like Miles Davis. You know, he changes. And what happens is that, you know, we like to sometimes pick out the King that we like, the same way we pick out the Malcolm X that we like. You know, we look at Malcolm X, not El Hajj Bleek El Shabazz. So we see Malcolm at a point in which, you know, we like his militancy, but not his spiritual development. And I think that with King, you know, King's beauty is as a philosopher and also somebody that begins to really grapple with the economic problems of our country and not just the race problem.
Gilda, go ahead.
I think it's also very easy to make everything a soundbite, because we want everything to be easy, and we want people, you know, to just give them a little bit so that they can remember it. But I think we've certainly done Dr. King a disservice in this way, that we have limited him almost to a fable or a superhero. Mm-hmm. I have an 8-year-old son, and, you know, we're very much into superheroes. And I think we've made him a superhero that he's almost unapproachable, that we can't attain the level of service that Dr. King certainly and others in the civil rights movement attain. And I think this article does a very good job of certainly, again, making him human, mm-hmm. right, and helping us to understand certainly the complexities of living in that time, as well as, you know, being seen as the leader of the movement during that time, that it was much more complex than we then, you know, talking about the content of your character, right? Taking sound bites from a speech or saying, I have a dream, right? When the I have a dream speech was about the bankruptness of our democracy, mm-hmm. right? That the United States had issued African Americans a promissory note and they were coming to Washington, D.C. to cash in. Right. And so that's a radical message that is much more radical than, you know, I have a dream or content of your character. Right. That we need to certainly wrestle with even today as we look at, you know, the state of our country and where it is that we want to go and how his writings, how Dr. King's writings can even continue to lead us during this time in our history.
Stacey. Well, and Gilda and I were talking about this as we were walking in, but, you know, back to the point about him being like a mythical figure, and, you know, so much of who he was not about just him himself. And I think, you know, what this article does a wonderful job of is talking about him and his concept of the collectiveness of us all, and like I like to call it the we-ness, that the movement was not about him. You know, and the movement was not just about issues around African Americans. And I think sometimes people get so caught up in just looking at him and putting him on this, you know, unattainable pedestal. And, you know, just to piggyback on what Gilda was saying is that this makes all that he symbolized accessible to all of us, as I think it should be.
He really was thinking in a much broader sense about the kind of society that we should have and want to build, and I think about how late in his life he talked about the burning house, and you know, I've integrated us into a burning house. I'm just was something that he said, and in burning house being America and this society that we've created. And one of the things he said, I just throw this out from the article that Charles Johnson wrote. This quote he has, said, we shall have to create leaders who embody virtues we can respect. We must be sure that our hands are clean in the struggle. And then kind of quotes the piece that he said to the Freedom Riders in 1960. King said, our ultimate end must be the creation of the beloved community. And he talks about the beloved community a lot. And he talked about the problems of capitalism a lot. And in many ways, he kind of brought these in is almost like a Christian socialism that he kind of took to believe that we could create in America a different way. And I think that's the part of King that we don't want to talk about often, because it has to do with his spirituality. It has to do with a world he thinks that could exist that doesn't exist now. So what does that King say to us now? Who is that King? What does that King mean to America?
Well, Mark, the only person basically talking about the beloved community consistently is probably John Lewis.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's the only person I hear whenever he comes out. That's part of his vocabulary. The other thing is that if we look at King's, you know, last book, the title is, you know, where do we go from here, which everybody's always using for some sort of conference, you know, where do we go from here, chaos or community, which is the full title. And when we look at it, chaos or community, he's talking about the beloved community, okay? And that's why in the last chapter of that book, he's thinking of the World House. He has an international global vision, you know, that is rooted in the whole thing of nonviolence and Gandhi, but he expands on it. And what happens is, once again, we fail to do the heavy lifting when we teach and talk about King. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the problem is with ourselves in terms of how we reduce somebody into our curriculum, how we teach, how we talk about them through the media, okay? And keep in mind, each new generation is going to see a watered-down King. Some people are going to take him, and he's going to be a big person on the mall, and we'll look at him like at Lincoln sitting.
Right.
And I think we need to think about civil rights as a vocation, right? We have a tendency to talk about civil rights and attaining equality as if it's something that was in the past. It's almost like a dinosaur that it ended, you know, at the assassination, on King's assassination. But we certainly have to, certainly Dr. King wanted us to continue to work in that area. And one of the things that he said was, whatever career you may choose for yourself, doctor, lawyer, teacher, let me propose an avocation to pursue it along with it. Become a dedicated fighter for civil rights is what he said. Mm-hmm. And so knowing that that fight would certainly continue, I saw an article recently that talked about how the next that civil rights was essentially dead, that now we're just looking at gay rights, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender rights, which is important. But the fight for equality based on race continues, right? Certainly race, gender, disabilities, et cetera, those kinds of issues continue. And I think when Dr. King is talking about, you know, where do we go from here? Certainly he wants us to think broadly, you know, certainly as a community, and to continue to fight for equality even today. And that fight certainly continues, and we need to, you know, focus on that as well.
Can I pick up on something there?
Sure, Stacey. Then I'll go right to Stacey. Go ahead, Ethel. But I'm sorry.
But what's very important is, see, we look at these movements as if, you know, they're coming after. It's consistent. Yeah. We could go back and look at how King dealt with Betty Rustin when people were trying to drive Betty Rustin out of the movement because of his sexual orientation, and King refused. You could look at King's relationship with Billy Strayhorn. You know, the gay presence there was always there, and people respected people as individuals. Okay. You know, they respected people for their spirituality, and they respected people for their intellect, and they were not going to marginalize somebody because somebody said, okay, I'm gay or something like that. Those words come in later because now we have a gay movement. But the whole thing is King was not homophobic, you see? And we have to teach people that, okay, if you want to teach King, what would his position be today? Look at how his position was back in the 50s and 60s. And that tells you a person in terms of the person. You know, he was not going to push his friends aside because the government was going to try to blackmail him, okay? And I'm certain that he would be fighting for Betty Rustin's right, you know, to marry if he wanted to get married in 2015. And that's how we have to teach our movement. We can't teach our movement and our leaders based on our biases. Like, for example, let's go back to this essay, right, by Charles Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he includes the commandments for the volunteers for SCLC, okay? Mm-hmm. And let's put King aside for a minute. Let's look at those commandments, and then let's compare the movements of the 60s with the movements of today. Let's just deal with language. No cursing at the march. No F the police, okay? That's a different type of movement if you go out there and say F the police in 2014, 2015, okay? There's a loss of the spiritual aspect of your movement right there, just in terms of language.
Well, that's a really interesting point, I think, Stacey.
Absolutely. And I also think it's hard for us as a country to see that we have a lot of these elements in common that bring us together, that there's this thing called social justice, there's this thing called justice. And I think we get so often caught up in, well, that's not my issue, that's so-and-so's issue, that's so-and-so's problem. And, you know, going back to the article and going back to Dr. King, it really wasn't these individualized things. And those are the things I think as America we struggle with. I don't think we, you know, I teach a class in culture, and we talk about individualistic cultures. America's an individualistic culture. We don't particularly see ourselves as a collective. So bringing us together is sometimes it's very, very difficult because we don't see those things that we have in common, you know. And so, you know, I would be so encouraged to see us see ourselves as a collective. Mm-hmm. But there will be so many groups of people or so many individuals who will say, well, I that doesn't have anything to do with me.
And I think we've lost our sense of community. I think what I hear you saying, Stacey, is certainly when we're talking about community and how we defined community in the 1960s, right, based on our race, because certainly there were clear demarcations of what white people could do and what colored people could do, certainly in the 1960s and certainly prior to that. And now we've broadened, even within the African-American community, right, we have different, we think differently, right? Mm-hmm. We're much more complex than what's, you know, what's black and what's white. And I think we certainly need to, you know, as we continue to define community, right, the way Dr. King would define community, right, is humanity, right? And looking at all humans. And that's why I think as he evolved into looking at the issue of poverty towards the end of his very short and dynamic life, right? He was about equality and how do we achieve equality on many, many levels, right? Not just... and certainly getting rid of segregation, but also on an economic level as well. And I think that's the broader issue as we, you know, as we certainly on this day and other days limit him to one speech. He was much, much broader than that.
What does it mean for us now when you think about King? And we're going to go to break here and think about this and come back. That yeah, he did believe, as he did with the Poor People's Campaign. And in the next hour, we're going to play a clip from King that people don't usually hear when he was speaking to poor people in Mississippi. But in that speech, he wanted to build an inspirational movement of the poor in this country to create a political force to take on what he saw as the evils of capitalism in this country. He also, in that speech and other speeches, made clear about what American history had, what happened in American history to black people in America, the disenfranchisement, the funding, as he says in the speech, of giving money for white farmers to have a piece of land and state land-grant colleges to support them in knowing how to do it and more money to teach them how to farm, and that black Americans only had their land stolen and that it's unequal and that we have to have – and he was almost talking for reparations in a sense without using that word. So this is the sense that we are all in this together as a humanity and has to come together in a kind of a loving community that is nonviolent to its core, which he thought was antithetical to civilization. At the same time, he was talking about the oppression of black community that has – in some ways, I think, saying that has to be at the lead of the struggle to change America or we'll never change. So I'm going to talk about what that complexity means and how we talk about that in America today. We're going to come right back to that with our guests. So don't go away. We're going out here with Loving You by the wonderful Minnie Riperton. The song was released on this day in 1975, one of the great voices of our time. We'll be right back.
Making love with you is all I want to do. Loving you is more than just a dream come true. And everything that I do is out of loving you.
I stumble to the kitchen, pour myself a cup of ambition, and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets, the traffic starts jumping with folks like me on the job from 9 to 5.
Welcome back. That's Mark Steiner, and that's Dolly Parton's 9 to 5, born on this day in 1946. And Martin Luther King had something to say about those kind of working conditions and made me think of that song juxtaposition to 1968 when I was a young organizer with the Poor People's Campaign. And our job was to organize people in Appalachia and poor white communities to come to Resurrection City. And I hear Dolly Parton, that kind of pops my head of the music I listened to as I was doing that organizing. We're here with E. Ethelbert Miller, one of America's greatest poets, a literary activist, who is director of the African American Resource Center at Howard University, Dr. Gilda Daniels, who is associate professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, and Dr. Stacey Peterson, associate professor and chair of Communications Arts School of Arts and Sciences at Notre Dame of Maryland University, and you at 410-319-8888. So just going back to where I left off about this kind of world of King, which clearly saw that the only way America is going to be reformed is through the end of oppression in the black community, understanding that history, at the same time trying to build a world that stretches beyond the black world in terms of what has to change America. Ethelbert, I mean, that's in some ways, given the divides in America, the racial divide in this country, given the what I'm feeling and sensing every time I go out to speak and see demonstrations of the increased kind of frustration and anger of many young African Americans over what's happening in this society and feeling like it's time for us to leave and separate because we can't this place is never going to change. So we're at a cusp, and again, in American history, and I think that argument King was trying to make, that complex argument, is one we have to figure out how to wrestle with.
Well, not just wrestle with, we got to put King back in context. You know, King is just not an individual. King is being pressured by grassroots organizing. You know, you look at what the people of SNCC were doing.
Right.
They were really dealing with poor people. They really knew the economic conditions. They knew the importance of registering people to vote. But they also knew that the people could only change their life unless they were able to be economically empowered. Okay? So you have that factor. Then you're also dealing with what's going on internationally, you know, where you have the various movements around the world which is influenced by socialism. I mean, when we're talking about the early 60s, come on, Fidel Castro is in power. You know, people are hijacking planes, you know, trying to get down there. the influence of the Cuban Revolution, just using one revolution, on the consciousness of people around the world is very immense, you know, in terms of people realize, okay, there must be an alternative in terms of economic conditions. Now, see, in 2015, you got to go out here and find somebody and say, I'm a communist, you know, and carry a little communist manifesto over there. So you can't find that right now. You might find somebody listening to Jay-Z, but ain't listening to Marx. You know what I'm saying? That's the okay. So what happened, when you put King back in perspective, look at all the things around him. People, young people back then were pushing King to take a certain position on the Vietnam War, pushing him to deal with some of the economic problems that they had seen firsthand. I mean, bringing somebody like James Foreman, just in terms of style, James Foreman is wearing coveralls, you know what I'm saying, in solidarity with the people that he was working with. Now, let's go to 2015. You want to talk about the style of the people who are protesting in terms of his clothes and fashion design? Don't get me started. But back then, King was part of a movement, Mark, and that's all I'm saying, and I think your guests realize that also.
Absolutely. I think also when you're talking about his moving towards the poor, one of the things that Dr. King said was that racism was a great lie that was being told to poor white people, right, in order to divide, to create division when poor white people certainly had more people, or white people have more in common mm-hmm. with black people or with economically disadvantaged white people, more so than the things that divided of the, you know, white people from black people. And he said it was a great lie that was certainly being told, and that in order to, and again, as an example of broadening his approach, and I think if you're looking at moving forward to 2015, and we have these very, what I call organic protests, right, they just kind of rose up, right, all of, and certainly from Ferguson and Eric Garner and other issues, but they're very organic and very different from 1950s and 1960s, where it was very strategic. Right, and there's another, you know, we have in our folklore, right, that Rosa Parks' feet was hurting, and that's why she sat on the bus. No, it was months of planning and
years of being a revolutionary activist in this country from the 30s to the 40s.
Absolutely,
wasn't feet,
absolutely, right? Absolutely. And so looking at today, you know, certainly it's. Mr. Miller was saying in regards to the difference between 1960s and 2015 or 2014 and 2015, certainly we have yet to see, you know, what will come from these protests, because they are very organic and you know, to what extent that they can agitate and certainly, as Frederick Douglass said, so that we can make the persons in power actually make some changes.
So, go ahead, Stacey.
Well, I was just adding to the points about economic disparity. It's a place where many of us have a lot in common. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's one of those things that we don't feel comfortable talking about. It's one of those things that it can pull us together. So many of us have those same experiences, like you were just saying before about separating blacks and whites, the poverty issue. Mm-hmm. But when you look at it, you know, a poor person is a poor person. I mean, yes, there are other dynamics that definitely play a role in that, but you have a lot in common when you say, you know what, I don't have any running water, you know, or I don't have enough money to make ends meet at the end of the month or whatever. Somebody else has that same experience, and they may be black, they may be white, they may be Latino, they may be all kinds of different things. And I think that's a conversation that we just have a hard time having in our society about the haves and the have-nots and who the have-nots are and what the have-nots have in common. Mm-hmm. I just saw a piece on the news as I was getting up this morning about the 1% mm-hmm. and how that 1% is getting, like, bigger. And well, they're having more. They're having more money.
Their
more
wealth
of
is
that.
Growing.
Yes.
Right.
And so I sit there as a so-called middle-class person, and I'm thinking, my wealth is not growing. You know, what am I supposed to do to get my wealth to grow? And then what about the people who are worse off than I am? So I just think that economic issue is one that can really pull people together and form a foundation of where people can unite together. But it's one of those conversations that we don't know how to have it, or we're uncomfortable having it, or we just don't do it.
And you know, King thought about these things. I'm going to go to the phones here in a minute, but I want to raise something that Ethelbert raised. But let me just this quote, you know, and we'll probably use the next hour as well, that this is something he wrote in 1952. in a letter to Coretta Scott. He wrote to her, "I imagine you already know that I am much more socialistic in my economic theory than capitalistic. Capitalism started out with a noble and high motive, but like most human systems, it fell victim to the very thing it was revolting against. So today, capitalism has outlived its usefulness." And he wrote that in 1952 and had made a similar statement publicly in 1951. So this is a man who's wrestling with these issues from the beginning.
Yeah.
Not something it happened at the end. He was always thinking about it.
But you know what, Mark? You know what would be interesting? If he's saying that around that time, it would be very interesting to see to what extent is he influenced by W.E.B. Du Bois.
Hugely. Mm.
Because what happened, you see, Du Bois would be making that change, you know, as we get into the 40s and 50s. Also, you got Robeson. And then also, you got Shirley Graham Du Bois, who apparently people feel pushed W.E.B. Du Bois a little bit to the left.
Yeah.
A lot of socialist friends. But right around that time, he's listening to all those individuals. And then you got to throw in, you know, Howard Thurman in there also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't always have to throw in Howard Thurman.
Yeah.
I mean, the heart of his philosophical and spiritual thinking was Howard Thurman.
And Mark, can I say also, I think one thing that we have to remember when we're talking about Dr. King is that it was a long walk to freedom, as Nelson Mandela had certainly said, that, you know, we need to think about, as we think about certainly in movements, contemporary movements, that, you know, just to having a protest one day, you know, it has to be connected with other things in order to achieve, you know, if, you know, certainly some level of change, and that we need to think about, you know, how we can connect these movements or these actions so that you can actually see some changes in our situation economically, or even in the criminal justice system, mm-hmm. or as well as in voting rights and other areas.
So I'm going to come back to something you were saying, Ethel. Folks who just called in, please call back. I'm sorry I missed your calls. Jesse and the rest, 410-319-8888. Want to hear what you're saying. And what you're thinking. So please join us here as we reflect on this aspect of King here. 410-319-8888. But Ethelbert, I want to pull something out of you here that you alluded to a moment ago. When we look at Martin Luther King and what happened in those days, and we look at the protest today, and you made some aside about your feelings about what's happening today.
Well, what happens is, in terms of today, I mean, I'm against people thinking that, okay, all of a sudden the movement pops up. I mean, it's an ongoing movement, okay? You know, so, you know, you can't talk about Ferguson without talking about what was going on in the Occupy in New York and Oakland.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You
know,
you can't
Absolutely.
Talk about the fact that we had large immigration marches here. You know, I mean, this is the full history. It isn't like, you know, I get some popcorn and come back and, oh, we're up to the civil rights movement again. You know, it's a consistent movement, and it's international. You see, one of the things, when I look at the black movement, I look at points where sometimes it's a peak, you know?
A peak?
Yeah, well, sometimes, like, the strength of the movement might be in Brixton. The strength of the movement might be in South Africa. You know, just, you know, I mean, it moves around, you know what I'm saying? And what happens is that right now it's back in the hands of African Americans. You know, with somebody saying, like, look what the black people are doing here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And what are we dealing with? We're dealing with police. I mean, we're dealing with the first level of the state. You know, we're out here arguing about the police. I mean, guys, come on. We know if you go back historically, any riot was some act of police brutality. You know, I mean, so we're still dealing with 001 racism.
Not 101, 001.
I can't even relate to this, Mark, because I grew up in the 1950s where the police was my pal, the PAL, the Police Athletic League. That's how I was. Dude, Ethelbert, what do you want to do when you grow up? You want to be a fireman, or I want to be a police officer? Do you hear any young black person 2015, they want to be police officer? So you want to change the police department in Ferguson? You want more black? Where are you going to get them from? Nobody wants to be a police officer. You see what I'm saying? And that's a problem, because what happens? People don't even want to defend their community. You see? At one time somebody would say, I want to be a police officer because I want to help young black kids. Nobody says that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to redefine. What you should do, Mark, the people that I've been talking to, talk to African-American police officers.
Right.
They take pride in their job.
Yeah.
And it's not just a job. They see it as a sacred trust between the people. That is very, very important, because they are invisible. Talk to African-American police women.
Mm-hmm.
okay, who have come on the force and trying to make some gains within this department. We want to talk about reform. Talk about an African-American police woman. And she'll talk about the need of the sexism of the police department. Okay? But these are the things I feel that, you know, this is how the times have changed. You see? And if King was here today, he probably would be marginalized even further. Because that's how our movement, people don't want to talk to anybody who's an elder. King would be an old man.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
No time for him to say anything.
And he would be also marginalized because, in some way, because before he died, he, in fact, in people's minds in America, for most people, he was marginalized.
Yeah,
he was hated by the vast majority of American people, period, before he was assassinated.
Right, look at what happened when King went out to what?
Right. Or Chicago.
Or Chicago.
I mean, so do you want to jump in on this before we go back to open the phones here?
I think it just speaks to the point, again, that we just have to think broadly, certainly today as we're looking at. It's not just about Ferguson, and it's not just Ferguson, Missouri, right? There are issues that we need to, you know, to speak to, that move, you know, that we need to, you know, what about the murders in Chicago, right? We need to talk about those kinds of just broader issues. We have much broader issues.
Well, I wonder, because he was so powerful in his rhetoric, would he maybe have been able to give us a place where we could come together talking about those different things, making us see that those things are interconnected and they bring us together in areas that we can, you know, stand up against? I don't know. Well, I mean, we won't know.
See, we're dealing with I might open the phones here, but we're dealing with a world today that is very different. There was an article that came out, a study that came out just the other day. And I've only read part of this study, and we're going to do a little program on this, because I was really fascinated by what I read, that young people who live in the inner city of Baltimore have a more difficult time making it than kids growing up in poverty in Lagos, Nigeria. And I have not read the whole study. I don't know what it says. I don't know what it's based on, but that was a study that I just read the headlines of, and I want to read more of it.
But we're dealing with
a world, Ethelbert, that is people feel like they are the refuse left over by the end of segregation and stuck in a world they can't get out of.
But Mark, let me just be different. If I went and got a young Richard Wright before he wrote Native Son, and he was studying what was going on in Chicago among the black people, especially black young people, come on. That was the same problem back when he was writing Native Son.
Right.
Chicago hasn't even changed. I still got a little guy looking when he wants to be a fly airplane. He's still hanging out with his pool friends. I mean, this is Richard Wright looking at the black community back then, and I could take passages, and we're all still bigger.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yes, absolutely.
You know, I mean, Chicago hasn't changed. It's gotten worse.
I think another point that's in the article that we haven't really touched on is the spiritual aspect of Dr. King. Right? It's interesting that this is a Buddhist paper. This article in the Buddhist paper, and it's really talking about how he was a spiritual man. He was really a spiritual man first. And I think also that gave him a central place, certainly during that time in our history. The church was a central place to protest, right? And it was seen as a place where you could voice your opinion and you would have a community of people. And we don't have that today, unfortunately. And so we need, you know, what is the center? We have so much social media now. I'm still trying to navigate my Facebook page. I don't know. And so where do people go now to hear that voice, to come together as a community and to speak and work on issues that are important, and so that can help us change the way we see things and the way we live.
Well, and people may argue that social media is right where they go. Mm-hmm. You know, that there's this group and this like-minded people, and they're having these conversations that they can relate to. I know I'm not on social media, so when things are happening,
you teach it, but you don't do it.
Exactly. And for all kinds of different reasons. Uh-huh. But, you know, when they had the march here in Baltimore, and you know, it just, I know that this people are talking to each other on social media and they're saying, we have to do this. We have to be here. We have to get together. And da-da-da-da, there they are. And I'm saying to myself, man, how did I not know about this? Because I'm not on social media. So there are some places where I see it being very useful and forming a sense of community. And then there's some other elements about it, too, which that's another show.
But what can I also say, it was his spiritual self that that helped him, right, to become and do all the things that he did. And that piece,
yes,
you know, is knowing that he was, you know, fighting for something bigger and, mm-hmm. and it, you know, that he believed in God. And that is what helped him. And I think also at this article, one of the things that I got from this article is that, you know, we certainly need to have a spiritual base, mm-hmm. right, so that it's in order to help us.
And, well, this could be an interesting program to do another day, which I wanted to get into today, but the time is running out, which is that King's view of God was very different than what people think it was. Mm-hmm. King didn't view God as this person you pray to and get an answer from. He saw it as a much more vast thing that people had, that God was within you. That's where he took Howard Thurman. And people like Martin Buber, and took their philosophies of existence and spirituality in the universe, and that's what he believed. You'll find, it's interesting, you find very few references to, there are some, but not in the way you'd think, to Jesus and salvation in his sermons. He didn't go there a lot.
But he talked about service.
He talked about service.
Service,
that,
which is
our life is supposed to be with what you do for others, not just what you do
and
for
yourself.
And
that's a Christian, yeah, that's a tenet, right?
Absolutely.
It's service.
Let me get to the phone here before we go back to our guest in Ethelbert, 410-319-8888. Eddie in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Oh, yes. Good day. How are you doing?
Very well. Welcome.
Yes, I've been listening to your program, and it's very nice. I just want to say a few words, because, you know, it's... dawn on me that a lot of us are not really understanding what's going on in the world today. Because, for instance, after slavery, you know, and after slavery, the plantations were still controlled by certain individuals, and they were the masters. And during being the masters, economics were the thing that they had to get. They had to be above everyone else. So what is still going on today is still a situation where certain people have to be above and has to keep certain people below. And it's been the doctrine since after slavery. So my concern is that, you know, a minimum wage is one of the greatest sins that anybody can put on someone, because the minimum wage kept people down for so long and they would not raise it. Because if they raise it, some people figure they won't make no profits. And this is the problem. People need to talk about minimum wage. This is the greatest sin to human beings as far as black folks, colored people, people of color. Because, you know, you're not going to get anywhere if you can't make a good living. And this is the problem. People need to start talk about minimum wage and make that a very strong issue.
Eddie,
that's all I have to say.
Eddie, I appreciate your thoughts. We'll come to that. Let's get to Beverly at 410-319-8888. Beverly, you're on the air.
Hi, Beverly. This is Beverly Little. I wanted to thank Dr. Gilda Daniels for her insight on, you know, the economic divide that we have. I think her point about that being the crux of bringing community together and really honing in on that aspect of where we are today. I wanted to see if she had a little more additional insight on, you know, how we could bridge that gap. Just a couple of additional points about bridging that economic divide and really getting to a place where we can have more community.
But King would have things to say about that. In one of his speeches, he said that you have to invest billions and billions of dollars in America and put people to work, mm-hmm. that you have to, and that it's a societal question. It's nothing that you can't bridge here in Baltimore City or Washington, D.C. or New York. It's something that's a much larger issue in America that it has to be bridged by the force of political power, is what he would be saying.
Right. Hey, Mark, could I say something here?
Yeah,
going
sure.
Back to the caller before. If you go back, and this is a thing, maybe you might want to do a show on this. We talk about slavery, okay? This person was talking about slavery. We need to focus more and more on the period of Reconstruction.
Hmm. Yes.
Okay? There is where we begin to see the economic challenges for black people. This is where you begin to see some of the collaboration between races. And we have to ask ourselves, what were the successes of Reconstruction, and why did Reconstruction fail? And then another thing we want to talk about, you know, ways and stuff. Pull aside black people, for example, and ask them, how many union songs do they know? Okay? What is the level of labor history that the average young African-American person know? Okay? Okay, so let's bring to mind, like, A. Philip Randolph. Okay, how do we know about A. Philip Randolph in terms of unions and stuff? You know, is that being taught? So we might want to say, okay, you know, I work at McDonald's, but I don't even have any labor history. What are the major strikes of the last couple of years? You see what I'm saying? Introduce a young black class to air traffic controllers and Ronald Reagan. That's what we should be teaching Black History Month. Right. And you can bring King into that.
Oh,
because
my goodness.
You can see the King Monument when you're flying into airport, okay? And that's where you can make the connection from the cloud of the dream to the monument to the air traffic controllers who are still, you know what I mean, a union that was busted. And that's very important for young people to understand. And some of that can be the type of black history that you can learn from talking to your mother or father. You see? You can teach Martin Luther King economics for black families in Detroit from the auto industry layoff.
All day long. All day. Can't speak to Beverly's point. I think the poverty rate in 1966 for blacks was 41.8%, which was nationally the poverty rate for all races was 14.7%. In 2011, the poverty rate for blacks was 27.6%. But nationally, the poverty rate for all races was 15%. So you didn't see a shift in the national poverty rate. You did see a shift in the poverty rate for blacks, but it's still almost twice of what it is for the nation. So to deal with, you know, these economic issues, it would take more than a show to talk about how we can certainly deal with the economic divide. But it is certainly consistent with what Dr. King would say in regards to how we do need to focus on, you know, getting people out of poverty. And you do that a number of ways. Certainly education, I think, is one of the places you start. And you know, that's also seemingly something that we've lost as well in the African-American community, right? My parents always told me education was the first, you know, was what you needed to focus on, and then then you move on. So certainly education, and then creating opportunities, right? And you know, churches do a lot, I think, we certainly have churches in Baltimore and Prince George's County and other places across the country that can put money into the community and certainly help in regards to building up our community economically. And I think that's something we need to, certainly something we need to focus on.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the economic question is huge. I mean, when we talk about poverty, when they say 27% of America lives in poverty, or black America, we're still dealing with defining poverty from the war on poverty's numbers in 1964-65. That has very relationship to what poverty really means in America. Mm-hmm. My guess is poverty in America is much bigger than that. Mm-hmm. That it's probably closer to the 40% it was in the 60s because of the way we define poverty then having to do with food. And we don't take into account rent or salaries. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you make $12,000 a year and live by yourself, you are not considered poor in those statistics in America. Mm-hmm. So we got to figure out what do we mean even by poverty in this country today. Let's go back to the phones here and try to get a quick call. We have last words. There's only 3 minutes left. So the caller's calling in now. Stay with us. We're going to continue this discussion with our next panel here on the Steiner Show. But let's go out of the room real fast and have your final thoughts on where we've been and did not really get to the heart of what I wanted to get to. My fault with what Chuck Johnson was writing here about nonviolence as a way of life around building this kind of community of believing the understanding that history is a process and not a moment. So you can think about George Wallace not in the moment, but how he might change in the future, and that integration and independence is part of our life's blood and being. That's part of what we're talking about here. We didn't get to any of that. We'll come back to a show just with that soon. But Ethelbert, help us close out here. We'll go around the room.
Oh, yeah. I just would encourage everybody to perhaps pick up a copy of A Testament of Hope, Essential Writings and Speeches of Martin Luther King, Jr., it's edited by James Washington. You know, it's good to have these sort of one books, or you can download whatever you want. But I think, you know, just leading people back to certain texts, speeches, and sermons by King would be important.
Stacey Peterson.
Well, what I'd like to do is encourage people to think about what we have in common. And there are racial things, there are economic things, there are spiritual things, there are all kinds of things that we have in common. And if we can kind of get past what I like to call the superficial, which is the external, we can learn a lot about each other and figure out how to work together.
Mark, I also want to say I'm Professor Gilda Daniels. You gave me a doctorate.
I'll take your doctorate away from you right now. You just lost your doctorate.
No, I'm sorry. Just that quickly. My goodness, as quickly as I got it, I lost
that's
it. Oh, my goodness. I just want to say thank you. Thank you for having me on the program. It was a lot of fun, and it was wonderful meeting Stacey and also Ethelberg. And I do agree with all of them. I think with Ethelberg in particular, that we need to learn more, take this opportunity to learn more, not just about Dr. King, but about the movement and about the civil rights movement in general. And I wanted to say that civil rights is not dead, and that we should all work, and that the work continues, and that we should purpose to do the work and become better individually, better as families, better as a community, and we can be a better nation and a better world.
So Professor Gilda Daniels is Associate Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, and Dr. Stacey Peterson is Associate Professor and
Chair.
She earned hers. Chair of the Art School of the Arts and Sciences at Notre Dame of Maryland University. And my dear friend, E. Ethelbert Miller.
That's Master E. Ethelbert Miller.
Master Miller. Master Miller, I'm so glad you could join me again today. One of our great poets will be back shortly with Charles Johnson to talk about the piece they did together. He's director of the African American Resource Center at Howard University and much, much more. And now in the D.C. Hall of Fame as well. Ethelbert, thanks so much for being with us again.
Okay, thank you very much.
Take care,
man. Bye-bye, everyone.
Thank you both for being in the studio here.
Thank you.
Gilda and Stacey, great to have you here.
Thank you, sir.
We're going to break here with A Land of a Thousand Dances by the great Wilson Pickett, who passed away on this day in 2006. We'll be right back to continue our conversation about the economic philosophy of Martin Luther King. Stay with us. Johanna and the others calling in. We're going to come to your calls immediately.